They give us the actual review from Deba Voice and unseal the grand jury minutes. And although we know it's not what you know, it's what you can prove, I believe that if you do unseal these things, that we'll see that there was bias in favor of law enforcement. And other than that, may there be accountability for Kenneth Chamberlain Sr., and may there be accountability for all families impacted by police violence.
Well, again, our condolences. They are never too late, unfortunately. Kenneth Chamberlain Jr., son of Kenneth Chamberlain, shot dead by police in White Plains in New York in November of 2011. And Mayo Bartlett, attorney for the Chamberlain family. The city of White Plains, New York, has agreed to a $5 million settlement with the Chamberlain family, the largest settlement around police violence in White Plains ever. That does it for our show. To see our past interviews, go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
This program is made possible by KBOO members and the Portland Bureau of Transportation, currently seeking input from those living and working in or who regularly visit the Boise neighborhood about parking issues. Survey responses will help inform a parking management plan for the area. More information at portland.gov/Boise Parking.
Hello, dear listeners. Oil for Kisses is a monthly program on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, that highlights the headier and weirder sides of underground metal, post-punk, DIY hardcore, and beyond. Every month features a different theme where we delve into the history of a specific genre topic or musical location, or simply churn out the best, brightest, and ugliest sounds from around the globe. Join me, DJ Krauthammer, every first Friday night, Saturday morning of the month, at midnight till 3 a.m. for Oil for Kisses to experience it for yourself, only on KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Camp Creek wildfire threatens the Bull Run watershed.
Three people are killed in Jacksonville in a hate crime.
And Oregon Republican lawmakers who staged a walkout sue the Secretary of State.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 28th, 2023. I'm Reed Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Authorities say Portland's water supply is safe despite the Camp Creek fire burning less than 2 miles from the city's primary drinking reservoirs. A lightning strike on Thursday night sparked a wildfire south of the Bull Run Dam near the town of Sandy. The blaze has burned more than 1,600 acres and is 0% contained. That's as of this morning. The U.S. Forest Service ordered a helicopter and two other firefighting aircrafts to make water drops, prioritizing the protection of the Bull Run Dam. That's because nearly a million Portlanders use Bull Run Lake as their primary drinking water supply. Fire crews used some chemical fire retardants on Friday, but only in limited areas. Right now, it's not their main strategy. That would be using helicopters to scoop water from Bull Run Reservoir Number 1 and airplanes to pull water from the Columbia River. If things get worse, though, the Forest Service could decide that it's necessary to use fire retardant to prevent a catastrophic fire in the watershed. However, Multnomah County health officials do say the impacts on people's health would be negligible were that to happen. That's because the retardant is made up of mostly water, and the chemicals that are in it would be diluted by billions of gallons of water in the reservoirs. Long-term impacts to the Bull Run watershed remain to be seen, but keeping the area forested is a big part of keeping the water high quality. Portland has backup groundwater wells that can be used when Bull Run water is not available.
A white man fatally shot three African Americans inside a Dollar General store in Jacksonville, Florida. The victims include two men and one woman. The shooter used a gun painted with a swastika and also posted racist writings, leading Jacksonville Sheriff T.K. Waters to state that the attack was definitely racially motivated. The shooter, age 21, had previously been involved in a 2016 domestic violence incident and was involuntarily committed for a 72-hour mental health examination. Despite these incidents, the weapons used in the shooting were legally purchased earlier this year. Sheriff Waters said, quote, "This is a dark day in Jacksonville's history. There is no place for hate in this community. I'm sickened by this cowardly shooter's personal ideology," end quote. He also stated that the investigation will continue and that the FBI was helping the sheriff's office and has opened a hate crime investigation.
Meanwhile, residents in Jacksonville are mourning the victims of that shooting. As we've just reported, sheriff's officials say the assailant was motivated by a disgusting ideology of hate towards black people. Tramell Gomes has more.
People in Jacksonville are mourning the deaths of three black residents gunned down by a white man who left behind manifestos that have led investigators to believe the shooting was a hate crime. The victims of the shooting at a Dollar General store on Saturday were identified as 19-year-old Anolt A.J. Laguerre Jr., Gerald Deshaun Gallen, age 29, and Angela Michelle Carr, 52. The Jacksonville Sheriff's Office identified the gunman as 21-year-old Ryan Palmeter, who first attempted to drive through Edward Waters University, a nearby historically black school. Jacksonville City Council member Rockman Johnson is a professor at the university.
These three lives that were taken here in Jacksonville, I pray that they are not in vain. So rather than just grieving and crying, as Ayanna Van Zant once said, let's cry with a purpose, right? Let's grieve and then work.
As for what work entails, Johnson says he isn't quite sure just yet, but thinks there must be a serious focus on mental health for a community in trauma, and perhaps conversations around the systemic issues that led to this result. In a video statement, Governor Ron DeSantis condemned the shooting and called the gunman a scumbag. Johnson is reluctant to blame one person or group, but says this is what happens when diversity, equity, and inclusion is seen as the enemy, referencing the recent policy actions led by some state officials, including Governor DeSantis.
When we say we don't want to be able to interact with people who love differently than we do, who worship differently than we do, who live differently than we do, we then end up creating and watering seeds of divisiveness that give us the fruit that we now see, which is this heinous act.
Johnson also voices concern about the expansion of gun laws and new education standards in Florida that ignore the realities of African American history. He says, given the governor's position of advocating for these changes, he's unable to reconcile DeSantis's statement of condemnation.
When we say that African American history should be taught one way, that there could have been a value or benefit to slavery, or that people who, when the Constitution was authored, were not considered people, all of a sudden, all of that is supposed to be washed away, and we can't learn about that and learn from that. And I think that's antithetical to learning. So unfortunately, I don't see those statements nor the actions as being congruent.
Palmeter used an AR-15 semi-automatic rifle and a Glock handgun in the shootings. On Sunday, the local sheriff said he shot one person as she sat in her car outside the store, another just after he entered the store, and shot the third minutes later. 11 minutes after the shooting started and as police entered the store, Palmeter killed himself. The U.S. Justice Department is investigating the case as a hate crime. This is Tramell Gomes for Florida News Connection.
In local news, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler and City Commissioner Carmen Rubio propose expanding a tax-free enterprise zone downtown to keep businesses from leaving. There are enterprise zones in other parts of the city, and their plan would expand it into much of the downtown core and Northwest Industrial Area. Companies in those zones get special tax breaks. This includes paying no property tax for 5 years on new capital investments. That doesn't exempt land and existing equipment from property taxes. The resolution reads that it is a, quote, tool to revitalize the downtown core as affected by the pandemic by encouraging new investment and jobs in downtown Portland, end quote. Wheeler and Rubio plan to bring the proposal before City Council on Wednesday. Also on the docket for Wednesday is an offer meant to entice Daimler Truck North America to build its new expansion in Portland. That resolution would also grant specific tax breaks to the company if they decide to build in Portland.
Oregon Republican state senators have filed suit against the Secretary of State, saying that they should be allowed to run for re-election next year. These are the same senators who walked out of Oregon's last legislative session, rather, in order to block votes on abortion rights and gun control bills. This is despite a voter-approved law aimed at ending walkouts as a tactic in Salem. The five Republican lawmakers hope to convince the Oregon Court of Appeals that voters were misled last November when they passed Measure 113. Instead of being immediately barred from running again, the Republican senators argue that the actual verbiage in the state constitution allows them to run and serve another term before penalties take effect. Secretary of State LaVon Griffin-Vallade feels differently, as she issued an administrative rule earlier this month that blocks lawmakers who walked out from running again. She made it clear that she felt Oregon's voters' intentions take precedence over the ambiguous wording. The lawsuit against Griffin-Vallade will be seen by the Oregon Court of Appeals, with the potential for it to go directly to the Oregon Supreme Court.
Last week, right-wing media figure Annie Ngo won a $300,000 settlement from three defendants who failed to show up to court. Now one defendant argues they weren't legally served. Sam is shot. Deputy is one of the three defendants accused by Ngo of an assault during a demonstration in downtown Portland in 2019, in which Ngo was hit in the head by a milkshake. Shot deputy claims they had no part in the violence and did not know who Ngo was at the time. Ngo's evidence of shot deputy's involvement was a single still shot taken from video footage showing the defendant in the background. Ngo is a relatively unknown figure in 2019, but has since risen to national notoriety over his Twitter page. He's a self-described independent journalist who critics argue works intimately with far-right groups like Patriot Prayer. Ngo denies involvement with these groups. But he's been accused of manipulating videos posted to his Twitter page to emphasize retaliatory acts by left-wing activists against groups like Patriot Prayer as unprovoked violence. Ngo was previously fired from his position as editor with the Portland State Vanguard for a breach of journalistic ethics and misquoting a Muslim Portland State student panelist. Ngo recently sought damages against six people for a variety of assault claims between 2019 and 2021. One of Ngo's lawsuits was dropped after jurors concluded there wasn't enough evidence to fault the defendants for the attack. Now shot deputy claims Ngo's lawyers failed to exhaust their options of reaching out before seeking a default and pursuing their case in the defendant's absence. While Ngo's lawyers argued they couldn't track down the defendant, Ngo was able to post a comprehensive list of shot deputy's legal affairs on his Twitter page in June.
Thousands are commemorating the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. Green amendments seek to hold governments accountable for worsening climate change, and more on the federal civil rights investigation into the Jacksonville shooting. With more on those stories, it's Catherine Carley with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
This is a dark day in Jacksonville's history. Any loss of life is tragic, but the hate that motivated the shooter's killing spree adds an additional layer of heartbreak.
Jacksonville, Florida Sheriff T.K. Waters says a 21-year-old white gunman used a legally purchased handgun and an AR-15-style rifle to kill three black people there Saturday. Waters says the killer left behind writings that show a disgusting ideology of hate. The Federal Department of Justice has opened a civil rights investigation. Racism and gun violence were both addressed by speakers marking the 60th anniversary of the March on Washington. Martin Luther King III told the thousands of people gathered at the Lincoln Memorial that it takes only a few good people to bring about change.
Dad would probably say, now is the time. We must preserve, protect, and expand democracy. We must ensure that voting rights is protected for all people.
Organizers say the event can serve as a rededication to civil rights in the face of a backlash. They cited efforts to rewrite black history in the public schools, restrictive voting legislation, and the Supreme Court's ending affirmative action in higher education. Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy calls the Department of Education the head of the snake and wants to shut it down.
Allow any parent to choose where they send their kids to school. End the teachers' unions at the local level to allow public schools to compete.
Many Republicans at the state and federal level are pushing for the use of public tax dollars to pay for private and religious schooling. Conservatives say they plan to make what they call parental rights a top issue in the 2024 election. Youth climate activists nationwide want to put the right to a clean and healthy environment in their state's constitutions. That includes Maine, where student Audrey Huffnagel says it's basic to how people will live in the future.
And including it in the Constitution really just sets this baseline of, like, this is a fundamental right on par with the right to freedom of speech.
So-called green amendments are advancing in 9 states. Activists say they're drawing inspiration from a landmark legal decision out of Montana, which found the state was violating residents' environmental rights by promoting the use of fossil fuels. In Ohio, the GOP-controlled ballot board has altered the language for a proposed amendment to enshrine the right to abortion in the state's constitution. Secretary of State Frank LaRose cast the swing vote to approve the text, which now includes the phrase, unborn child.
This is 100% about keeping a radical pro-abortion amendment out of our Constitution. The left wants to jam it in there this coming November.
Critics call the text misleading and say Republicans are working to confuse voters when they see the language this fall. Several pro-choice ballot initiatives have won in red states since Roe was overturned. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on Coast Range Radio. At 6 p.m., it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 8, A Different Nature. Tonight's weather is partly cloudy with a low of 67 degrees. Tomorrow's weather, mostly cloudy with a high of 74. Today in history, exactly 60 years ago, Martin Luther King Jr. gave his famous I Have a Dream speech, eventually prompting the federal government to take more direct action to realize racial equality. The quote of the day is from Martin Luther King Jr. He said, quote, "Faith is taking the first step, even when you don't see the whole staircase."
A potentially widespread fuel contamination could cause cars and generators across Florida's Gulf Coast to stop working. This just as Tropical Storm Idalia approaches the region. According to the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, otherwise known as FDACS, human error caused diesel and gasoline to be mixed together at the Port of Tampa. The affected gasoline and diesel may have been sold to nearly 30 Citgo stations throughout the Tampa Bay region and south to Fort Myers. The FDACS warned that using the fuel could cause engine damage or stop the engine from operating entirely. The FDACS has asked the impacted stations to stop selling gas until the fuel can be replaced and the tanks cleaned. Florida's Division of Emergency Management has also waived restrictions for transporting gas and diesel into the state to ensure consumers have access to fuel. Forecasters warn Idalia could become a major hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico. Tampa Bay and Fort Myers are currently under an emergency declaration. Authorities encourage residents with vehicles to keep their tanks at least half full in case of the need for evacuation. The storm is expected to make landfall on Florida's west coast on Wednesday morning.
Some of the cases in a new Alaska missing persons report go back to 1960. The report is the first of its kind, and it maps out hundreds of cases. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A first-of-its-kind report on missing persons in Alaska has been released. The State Department of Public Safety and the Anchorage Police Department collaborated to collect the data. Austin McDaniel, a spokesperson for the Public Safety Department, says the report maps out hundreds of cases going back to 1960.
We think this is a good first effort, and we're definitely interested in adding additional data points.
McDaniel says the work, which is an outgrowth of the governor's People First initiative, will be updated every quarter and can be found online. In the last quarter, from April to June, 200 Alaska Native or American Indian people went missing in the state. Most of them have been found, except for 25. The database has an important new feature. It categorizes the circumstances surrounding the disappearances, identifying those which are suspicious. As director of the data for Indigenous Justice Group, Charlene Uphook welcomes the new report and says it's what advocates for missing Indigenous people have been asking for years. She worked on an earlier attempt to track their numbers.
sadly, I think what this really illustrates is a systemic issue of violence that's being perpetrated in our community in the state of Alaska. And that should raise flags and alarms and really start igniting justice.
She hopes the database will continue to improve and provide more information about those missing, including their hometowns and Native cultural identities, so they become more than just points of data, but reminders of loved ones lost to their families. Indigenous groups in Guatemala say they're prepared for massive protests if necessary to defend the results of last weekend's election. The vote saw a landslide by an anti-corruption candidate, which the Guatemalan government's now trying to overturn. Maria Martin reports.
About a dozen Maya and other indigenous groups met recently in the community of Totonicapan in the western highlands of Guatemala. They later issued a statement addressed to the people of Guatemala and the international community. In it, the influential Maya Quiche organization, 48 Cantones, 48 Villages, speaking for the collective, expressed profound concern at Guatemala's constitutional crisis, which they say is a result of, quote, constant and flagrant violations of the Constitution by an entrenched corrupt group that seeks to hold on to power. It's time for people to defend their vote, says 48 Cantones President Luis Pacheco Gutierrez.
Demostrar que los pueblos originarios, y no solo nosotros, todo el estado de Guatemala,
and to show that Native people, along with all Guatemalans, are uniting to oppose wrong decisions that are being taken. Enough is enough, he says. The indigenous authorities of Sololá, meanwhile, say if Guatemala's Attorney General Consuelo Porras continues to destroy democracy, they'll be forced to take over highways, airports, and offices of the public ministry. They're also calling for Porras' resignation. For National Native News, I'm Maria Martin.
The St. Regis Mohawk Tribe in New York has received an initial distribution of $1.3 million from a group of nationwide opioid settlements. The tribe was part of settlements reached in 2022 with drug manufacturers and distributors. The 2018 lawsuit contends companies that manufacture, market, and distribute opioids carried out a scheme to make individuals believe that prescription opioids were safe, non-addictive, and could be used without long-term effects. The complaint alleges that the scheme created an opioid epidemic that has ravaged tribal communities. The tribe has been working to combat the impacts, and the settlement will be used to support programs and services. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
U.S. policymakers have laid out a variety of plans to remove lead pipes from the nation's drinking water systems. However, organizations say there still needs to be a stronger standard for protecting public schools, and a key federal agency faces pressure to take action. Mike Moen has more in South Dakota.
With kids in South Dakota and around the nation back in school, the issue of whether all students and staff have access to safe drinking water remains a focal point of education and environmental groups. They want federal officials to update a key rule. Organizations such as the National Parent Teacher Association and the National Education Association have sent the Environmental Protection Agency a letter asking it to bolster the lead and copper rule, which regulates the levels of these contaminants in public drinking water. Environment America signed on to the letter too, and the group's John Rumpler says despite more awareness about the dangers, students and teachers still are at risk.
What the data shows us from the last few years is that lead contamination of schools' drinking water is in fact widespread.
Recent findings from his group show that more than 70% of schools in several states have confirmed instances of lead contamination. The Biden administration is carrying out funding initiatives approved by Congress to remove lead pipes. That includes $426,000 to address the matter in South Dakota schools. But Rumpler says updating the federal rule would compel more states, school boards, and utilities to respond. The agency is expected to consider the matter this fall, and advocates say they want the EPA to be aggressive. Despite an overhaul of the lead and copper rule in 2021, Rumpler still describes it as weak in protecting kids. He adds this is not just a concern regarding schools that were built decades ago.
The federal standards limiting the amount of lead in plumbing and faucets and fountains was only updated as recently as 2014, which means it's quite likely that school buildings that are only a decade old have a substantial threat of lead contamination.
The coalition says those materials should be replaced. Meanwhile, it says only schools that provide their own water are regulated under the federal rule. For those buildings, the letter calls on the EPA to require filters to remove lead and set a 1 part per billion limit on lead in water. They say those changes would also help guide school districts that use public water systems. Mike Moen, Greater Dakota News Service.
An ocean cleanup group has removed around 25,000 pounds of plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch this month. This is their biggest project yet, as they gear up for a much larger feat of removing nearly all of the world's ocean plastics by 2040. KBOO's Grant Button has more.
Ocean Cleanup successfully removed about 25,000 pounds of trash from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. Ocean Cleanup is a nonprofit environmental engineering organization aimed at ridding the world's oceans of plastic. Earlier this month, they managed to remove around 25,000 pounds of plastic from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch in around 4 weeks. It is the most plastic removed from the Great Pacific Garbage Patch ever. It's estimated that the patch has grown to twice the size of the state of Texas. It's large and prevalent enough to create a new coastal ecosystem thriving on it. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, garbage patches pose dangers to the local ecosystem by entangling marine life and causing animals falling ill from eating plastics. Today, plastic pollution in the world's oceans has affected nearly 700 marine species and caused an estimated annual economic cost of $6 to $19 billion worldwide. The Ocean Cleanup's long-term goal is to remove 90% of floating plastic from the oceans by 2040, which they believe is achievable. Ocean Cleanup says they plan to launch their biggest floating barrier system yet by the end of this month. It will be able to clear the size of a football field every 5 seconds and will be double the speed of the current system. After removing the plastics from the ocean, the organization sorts the plastics into two categories, recyclable and non-recyclable. The nonprofit then works with various partners around the world to ensure that the products made with the recycled plastics are not ones that will end up back in oceans or rivers. Ocean Cleanup's head of public relations, Alex Tobin, stated his organization aims bluntly. He said, quote, "Our goal is to kind of put ourselves out of business. We don't want to be doing this forever and ever." For KBOO News, I'm Grant Bunn.
California groups have identified possible locations for disaster resilience centers by creating an online tool to help map out spaces where people who are in need can get help after a natural disaster. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. During extreme weather, people often need a safe place to go. So some communities are planning to create resilience centers.
Resilience centers will be places where community members can go to have air conditioning during heat waves, to have access to air filtration during wildfires.
Yaneli Nunez is with the nonprofit PSE Healthy Energy. The group recently partnered on an effort to identify possible places in California for resilience centers. They created a free online map of schools, places of worship, and community centers. It shows the size and solar capacity of each. Then they overlaid that map with data on climate risks and poverty levels so users can see where resilience centers are most likely to be needed. Nunez says the map can reveal promising locations, but choosing one requires more consideration.
It's not just about identifying a building that has the characteristics that we're looking for, but also a building where people can form a sense of community that is welcoming to people from different backgrounds.
So she says it's important to get input from community members to make sure a selected location is a place they'll feel comfortable going for help. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, August 28th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971 971- 845-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Grant Button and myself. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Catherine Carley, Mike Moen, Mark Moran, Trimmel Gomes, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ree Johnson.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. That would be great folks like you. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or just text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Coast Range Radio and have a great night.
From the Coast Range Association, this is Coast Range Radio. I'm Michael Gasco. One of the most important questions in the drive to rapidly decarbonize our society is how to replace fossil fuel-generated electricity with clean, renewable sources. And one of the key questions there is, what counts as clean and renewable? Well, today's episode is all about biomass energy, which is essentially the burning of pelletized wood to create electricity. The biomass industry is big, valued at over $100 billion per year and growing, with many countries counting biomass as renewable and carbon neutral. But is it really? Or is it one more false solution, which is polluting communities, exploiting natural resources, and worsening the climate crisis? And with the biomass industry looking to expand into the Pacific Northwest, what does that mean for our timberlands and rural communities? To answer these questions, I'm